make up my mind about Dominic DeLuca. I wasn't ready for that. Soon, maybe. But not yet. Luck was on my side for once. We found a parking space a quarter of a block from the cafe, and even from there, we could see that the joint was jumping. The line wasn't quite out the door, but people were pushing their way both in and out, and happy tourists with their cups of cocoa and squares of gingerbread choked the sidewalk. Dominic freaked out when I mentioned monsters in public places. There was no way the Covenant would try to pull off an ambush with this many civilians around. Too many centuries of secrecy weighing them down. Mike took a few quick steps forward, putting himself in front of me, and proceeded to clear a path to the door simply through dint of walking with his elbows out and his legs a little farther apart than strictly necessary. People got out of the way without seeming to realize they were doing it. One more advantage to being a large male, rather than a small female. Then again, being a petite woman has advantages of its own. Once we were inside, I slithered around him and flashed a radiant smile at Sunil, who was manning the counter. He blinked, looking concerned for half a second, before plastering an artificially radiant smile on his face and declaring, "There you are! I was starting to worry that you'd forgotten about me, and were leaving me here to die of a broken heart." "Never," I said flirtatiously, and worked my way around the people between us to slip behind the counter. I leaned up onto my tiptoes, close enough that onlookers would assume I was kissing his cheek, and whispered, "The Covenant is coming. We need to get you out of here." Sunil laughed nervously. "Of course, sweetheart. Take your friend to the break room and I'll send Roshak to bring you some gingerbread while you wait." I nodded as I dropped to the flats of my feet. "See you soon, honey." Motioning for Mike to follow me, I started toward the back. A few people grumbled, but not many. Everyone's forgiving when romance is in the air. Too bad it wasn't real. My parents would have been thrilled if I'd come home with a nice cryptid boy, and Sunil was sweet. Literally. Mike trailed along behind me like a silent shadow, and I led him into the little employee break room where I once shared gingerbread and secrets with Piyusha, just hours before she died. True to Sunil's word, Mike and I were barely in the room when Roshak arrived with a tray of gingerbread and a white to-go bag of the same stuff. "What's going on?" he asked. "Nothing good," I replied, taking a piece of gingerbread. "Roshak, this is my uncle, Mike Gucciard. Uncle Mike, this is Roshak, one of the owners of Gingerbread Pudding."
"Charmed," said Uncle Mike, claiming his own piece of gingerbread.
"Likewise," said Roshak automatically. He turned back to me.
"What's going on? You don't normally drop by like this."
"How quickly can you close down and get out of here?" I asked. His eyes widened. I shook my head and continued. "Dominic, who may or may not be compromised, but that's a matter for later, just called me. There's going to be a covenant sweep of this neighborhood tomorrow. You need to leave, and you need to leave now."
"Now?"
Roshak glanced at the clock over the door.
"We close in an hour. If I try to clear this place out before then, it'll be a madhouse. I think the best thing to do is close normally, then put a sign on the door saying that we're doing inventory and will reopen after the weekend. That should buy us a few days."
"That sounds good," I said. "Do you have some place to go?" Roshak shook his head. I could practically feel Candy's glare on the back of my neck as I sighed and said, "Well, we do. Providing you can agree to stay inside until this is over, I've got a place you can go to ground."
"Is it safe?"
"It's as safe as any place else in this town. Safer if everyone stays careful and follows the rules. Kitty at the freak show would also be willing to give you sanctuary, if you don't mind bunking with her entire staff." Roshak made a face.
"I'd rather not. I'm unhappy enough at the idea of leaving the cafe without adding a bunch of strangers to the equation."
The nest was full of strangers, too, but there would be fewer of them. Maybe that would help. I decided not to mention it for the moment. "Then you come with us. We'll stay here long enough to let you shut things down, and then we'll take you back to our current haven."
Thank you.
Rorschach put the tray down and seized my free hand in both of his, holding tightly.
I don't know how I can possibly thank you enough. Thank you. You have no idea how much this means to us.
It's my job, I said. Then I blinked and repeated, almost wonderingly. It's my job.
Very?
Uncle Mike frowned.
You okay?
I'm fine. I just need to go upstairs and make a few phone calls. Rorschach, can I use your apartment?
He nodded, reclaiming his hand. Please. What's mine is yours.
Great. Have some more gingerbread, Uncle Mike. I'll be right back. I turned on my heel and left the room, heading for the stairs up to the second-floor apartment that Rorschach shared with his brother. I didn't look back. My dance partner wasn't home.
Hello, world. You've reached the home of James and Dennis Garcia. Leave your message at the tone and we'll call you when there's enough of a pause in the glorious adventure of our lives.
James's gleeful monologue was cut off by the sound of a shrill beep. I cleared my throat. James, it's Verity. You need to take Dennis on a nice vacation, and you need to go now. Someplace nice and far away. Maybe a cruise to Hawaii. Leave tomorrow, and don't come back until you hear that the city's clear. I hesitated before adding the second part of my message. When you get back, I think it's time for you to start looking for a new partner. We both knew this was coming. I wish it didn't have to end this way, but it's not fair of me to keep holding you back because my heart isn't in it anymore. Thank you so much for everything. You've been wonderful to dance with. I hung up the phone and stared blankly at the wall of Sunil and Rorschach's apartment for several minutes, waiting for my heart to start beating normally again. There it was. That was it. I was done. I could teach dance classes, I could participate in local competitions, but with one little phone call, I had finally put the nail in the coffin of my professional ballroom dreams. And oddly, it hurt less than I had expected it to. Maybe my parents were right when they said that spending a year away from home would be exactly what I needed to set my priorities straight. At the time, I'd laughed at them, saying that all a year in New York would do was make damn sure I never took off my tango shoes. When really, a year in New York was what it took to teach me that dancing was my heart, but cryptozoology was my soul. I shook my head, clearing away the cobwebs, and lifted my phone again. This time I dialed the freak show office. Kitty picked up, with a sultry, "You've reached the freak show. How may we fulfill your midway fantasies today?" "Okay, you have got to stop answering the phone like that. You sound like you're running a bordello, not a perfectly respectable titty bar." "Sometimes people can't tell the difference, and it helps bring in business," said Kitty, dropping the artificial seduction as quickly as she'd put it on. She was all business now. "What's the news, Verity?"
"I won't be coming to work tomorrow."
"I didn't expect you."
"Neither will Eastus." Eastus wasn't aware of it yet, but with as many non-combatants as we now had at the nest, either she or Ryan would need to be there at all times. It was a security measure.
"She's staying with me." "That's fine. Let her know that she'll be getting paid regardless, since you wouldn't be keeping her away if you didn't really need her. Anything else?"
"There are 3 Covenant operatives in town."
I sketched out their descriptions and provided their names, adding,
"Dominic may be traveling with them. I think he's still on our side, but it's hard to be certain, and there's evidence both ways. Watch for anybody seen in his company. He doesn't know where I am, and we're keeping it that way. The new Covenant folks have telepathy blockers that may work on other forms of psychic ability and confusion charms. Keep them away from the hide-behinds if you possibly can."
"Honey, I'm keeping the Covenant of St. George away from everyone I possibly can."
"That's a good approach. I'll keep you posted to the best of my ability. Things are about to get pretty messy around here, and I'm not sure how much time I'm going to have."
Kitty sighed. "Verity,
You've done more than anyone could ask you to. This isn't your fight.
I looked around the perfectly domestic little apartment, where once three siblings sat and dreamed of a new life, one that involved owning a dessert cafe of their very own. Below me, the two who survived would be shutting things down, getting ready to abandon their dream, even if temporarily, for the sake of their lives. They shouldn't have had to do that. No one should have to do that. Dreams mattered. I shook my head, even knowing that Kitty couldn't see it. "No," I said. "This has always been my fight. This is everyone's fight."
"Fine, then," said Kitty.
"What do we do now?"
I smiled into the darkness. It felt good.
"We win."
Chapter 15. I ain't sorry. You got that? I have never regretted a single minute of my life. And I ain't sorry.
Frances Brown. Back in the meatpacking district, still nicer than it sounds, in an increasingly full converted warehouse. It took us almost 2 hours to get back to the nest, thanks to Uncle Mike's evasive driving techniques, which included a trip through the Lincoln Tunnel. I spent most of the drive watching the mirrors for signs of pursuit. They never came. Sunil and Roshak goggled shamelessly as we entered the nest. Each of them had a suitcase, and Roshak was dragging a cooler filled with gingerbread, cookies, and jams of assorted types of sugar in both liquid and granular forms. I'd never realized there were so many kinds of natural sweetener. Watching a Madura pack his kitchen was definitely an education. Eastis was sitting cross-legged in the middle of the room, carefully stitching lace around the edge of one of her seemingly endless supply of parasols. She looked up as we approached, assessing us to see whether we presented any threat. The way her posture tensed told me she didn't know what Sunil and Roshak were. I started walking just a little faster, putting myself between Eastis and the others. "Eastis, this is Sunil and Roshak," I said, indicating them each in turn. "They're Madura." Her expression, a mixture of wariness and blank incomprehension, didn't change. I tried again. "They're cryptids, they're harmless, and they brought cookies."
"Why did you fail to open with the word cookies?"
Eastis set her sewing supplies aside and stood in a single fluid gesture. The smile she turned toward Sunil and Roshak contained a few too many teeth.
"Baked goods are one of the primary accomplishments of civilization."
"Along with?" prompted Uncle Mike.
I couldn't blame him. I'd been tempted to do the same thing.
"Waterproof mascara, conditioner, and bleach," said Eastis.
She cocked her head to the side, still studying the two Madura.
"My name is Eastis. I am a Wahila. Do you know what a Wahila is?"
"No,"
said Sunil. He hesitated before adding,
"Ma'am?"
Always play nicely with the predators of the world, and whether or not he knew what Eastis was, she was clearly a predator. Nothing else could hold so still while staring so intently.
"I am a therianthrope from the upper reaches of this continent," Eastis said, with perfect calm. "My people come from the ice and the snow and the tundra without end. I live here because I am considered a human lover, too soft and fond of people to be an effective hunter. Do you think I am soft?"
There was absolutely no good answer to that question. Sunil and Roshak shot me matching panicked looks. I sighed.
"Eastis, please play nicely. Sunil and Roshak are going to be staying with us while the Covenant is in town."
"We bake," said Sunil.
"Constantly.
And we share."
"Hmm."
Eastis considered them.
"I would extend my protection to you in exchange for cookies."
"Deal," said Roshak.
I rubbed my forehead with one hand. Between Eastis and the mice, it was probably a good thing we were importing our own dedicated bakers. Probably.
Okay, guys. Any open office is available for you to use as a bedroom, and we're going to get more inflatable mattresses. You've met Uncle Mike, and Ryan is... Eustace, where's Ryan?
He has gone to the freak show to collect some things, and to confirm that Kitty does not require our services.
Eustace bent and picked up her parasol, and she paused, sniffing the air.
I smell gingerbread.
Like I said, they brought cookies. I gave Rorschach a meaningful look. I like smart people. He opened the cooler, grabbing one of the medium-sized bags of ginger snaps and tossing it to Eustace. She caught it one-handed. It took her less than 5 seconds to open the bag, snatch out 3 cookies, and cram them into her mouth. Okay, that's Eustace taken care of, and you can meet Ryan when you get back. I should probably introduce you to the mice. That'll go better if you're willing to give up some more ginger snaps. That just leaves one more person. Hang on a second. I cocked my head, listening for the telepathic static of Sarah's presence. As soon as I started looking for it, I found it, lingering at the back of my mind like so much white noise. Sarah, I thought, as loudly as I could. Can you come to the main room for a minute? There's someone I need you to meet.
I'll be right there, she replied. I just need to get off the phone.
If she was on the phone, that meant she'd managed to reach Artie. That was a good thing. She'd be calmer after talking to him, and I didn't want to introduce her to her new roommates while she was still all worked up about losing her hotel again. Sarah was funny about privacy, that telepath thing again. She liked putting space between herself and other minds. The more, the better. I made a mental note to tell Sunil and Rorschach not to take the office directly next to hers. They were frowning at me, looking confused, while Eustace did her best to eat her way through the entire bag of cookies without pausing for air. I offered an apologetic smile. "Sorry," I said. "My cousin is coming down to meet you. Her name's Sarah. She's a telepath, but she's a very polite one, and she won't poke around in your head without permission." Somehow they didn't look particularly reassured. Rorschach put down his suitcase and coughed into his hand before indicating the cooler and asking, "Is there some place we can put all this? A cooler isn't exactly ideal for long-term storage."
"There's a kitchen," said Uncle Mike. "Come on, I'll show you. There's even some masking tape so we can label the stuff you don't want anybody else touching."
"Thank you," said Rorschach. He glanced to Sunil.
"Will you be all right here with Verity? If she were going to kill us, we'd be splattered all over the inside of the cafe by now, not standing in this godforsaken excuse for a refuge," said Sunil. He sounded tired. "Go on. Make sure everything's put away. I'll get us a room."
"All right," said Rorschach, and followed Mike out of the room. Eustace glanced between us and the cooler, and then went after the cooler, choosing the potential for more cookies over company. I couldn't exactly say that I was surprised.
"So," said Sunil.
"So," I agreed. I spread a hand, indicating the slaughterhouse around us. "This is home for the duration. The dragons lived here for centuries without getting caught. It should work for us for a few weeks."
"You really think this will be over in a few weeks?"
asked Sunil dubiously. "If it's not, I think it's unlikely to be my problem anymore, because I'll be dead," I said, and shrugged. "It's a hazard of the job. When you decide to be the immovable object standing in front of the unstoppable force, you'd better pray that you're right about being immovable, and they are wrong about being unstoppable. Otherwise, you'll wind up like a bug on a windshield," said Sarah. She sounded exhausted. I turned to see her coming down the stairs from the second-floor walkway. Her hair was loose, and her feet were bare. But apart from that, she was dressed exactly as she'd been when I'd left to get the boys from Gingerbread Pudding.
"I don't want to be the one explaining that to your mother, you know."
"So hopefully you won't be. Sarah, this is Sunil. Sunil, this is Sarah."
"Hello," said Sunil.
His eyes were a little wide. Not unusual in men meeting my cousin for the first time.
or in anyone meeting her for the first time. It's not that she's pretty, although she is. It's that her cuckoo mojo goes to work with Word One, trying to find a way into their heads. If Sarah wasn't careful, she'd have him thinking that they'd been friends since childhood, or that they were dating or married or who knows what else. "Sarah," I began. She flinched a little.
"Sorry. I relaxed while I was on the phone, and I just... sorry."
Her eyes flashed white as she clamped her shields down tighter. The telepathic static increased in volume at the same time, like keeping herself from changing the minds of people around her meant that it was harder for her to stay out of sight. That was good to know. Sunil blinked and shook his head, like he was trying to clear away cobwebs. His expression changed, going from bedazzled curiosity to fear, as he took a large step backward. Then he bowed deeply toward Sarah.
"What the hell?" I asked.
"I don't know," said Sarah.
Louder, she said, "Sir? Do you think you could stand up, maybe, and stop being weird?"
"My Lady Jorlak, if you allow me to take my brother and depart your hive, I swear we will never darken your door again."
Sunil was talking almost too fast for me to understand him. It didn't help that he was facing the floor.
"I did not know. I am sorry. I did not realize."
"What are you talking about, Sunil?" I asked. "Sarah's my cousin. This isn't her hive, it's our hiding place. If it belongs to anyone, it's mine, since I'm the one renting the place from the dragons."
He lifted his head enough to shoot me a deeply apologetic look.
"I can't save you. I'm so sorry."
"Right. Okay. I think I see what's going on here. You called her Lady Jorlak. That means you know what Sarah is, doesn't it?" The Covenant of St. George never figured out that the cuckoos existed. That didn't mean the other cryptids weren't aware, and Jorlak was the proper name for her species. Sunil's apologetic look turned panicked.
"You mean you know?"
"Jorlak," said Sarah, sounding not only tired but suddenly depressed. Discussion of her actual species tended to have that effect on her. "No one knows where we come from. No one knows how to send us back there, and most people don't know how to kill us. Everybody calls us cuckoos because a thing can be less scary when you have an easy name to hang on it. We steal lives and then we end them. Is that what you think I am?"
"Please, I meant no offense," whispered Sunil.
Sarah closed her eyes.
"Verity."
I stepped closer to her, putting a hand on her shoulder. "Sunil, Sarah is my cousin. Not by birth, maybe, but by adoption. Voluntary adoption. My grandmother, her mother, is also a cuckoo. She raised my mom. So my whole family is sort of resistant to the instinctive brainwashing. We like Sarah because she's Sarah. We love her because she's family. And she's not going to hurt you. She's here to hide from the Covenant, just like the rest of us. I've always done my very best not to take advantage of the people around me," said Sarah, opening her eyes and looking plaintively at Sunil. "It's hard sometimes. You can't even imagine how hard. But I swear, I'm not going to mess with your head."
"This is..."
Sunil frowned, finally straightening up.
"I've never heard of a Jorlak deciding to live among others as one of them, and not as their master."
"I do dishes, too," said Sarah.
"Sunil!"
Roshak reappeared from the direction of the kitchen, Mike tagging along behind him. Eustace was nowhere to be seen, possibly because the kitchen now contained a great deal of unguarded gingerbread. I hoped that Mike had asked her to leave some for the rest of us.
"Who's this?"
"My cousin, Sarah," I said, and braced for the explosion that was sure to follow. It didn't. Roshak stopped next to Sunil, looking speculatively at Sarah. Then he turned to me and asked,
"Your cousin is a Jorlak? How is that even biologically possible?"
"See, I'm a little more curious as to how you're identifying her on sight, but yes, she is. Is that going to be a problem?"
"No, I'm fully mature. She can't get inside my head."
He put a hand on Sunil's shoulder, turning back to Sarah.
If you hurt my brother, I will destroy you. Then I will find the rest of your hive and destroy them as well.
I'm not going to hurt your brother, and I don't have a hive, said Sarah. I just want this to be over before I miss too many classes.
Then we're in agreement, said Rorschach.
I blinked. Mature? What?
Madura are immune to the lore of the Jorlak once we pass our third molt, said Rorschach.
He nodded towards Sunil.
My brother has only passed his second.
Thanks for announcing that to the world, Rorschach, said Sunil, looking mortified. Don't worry. The world has no idea what it means, I said. Uncle Mike, can you show them to an empty office? Not one of the ones to either side of Sarah, please. I think we'll all feel better if we're not stacking people on top of each other. And maybe later, when all this was over, I could sit down with Rorschach and grill him on exactly how the Madura were able to resist the call of the cuckoo, something no other known species was able to do, except for possibly the Apraxis wasps, and those weren't something we could sit down and talk to. Not unless we felt like being stung to death and used to feed the hive's larvae.
I'm on it, said Mike. If you two gentlemen would follow me, I'll show you to your quarters. And to the bathroom, since you're probably going to want that eventually.
He started toward the stairs. Sunil and Rorschach followed him. In a matter of seconds, Sarah and I were alone. I looked toward her. You okay? I asked. She laughed unsteadily. Oh, I'm dandy. This has been the best night. The Covenant of St. George has telepathy blockers on their people, so I won't be able to hear them coming. I had to leave my hotel before I was ready, and I didn't have time to finish my homework first. I'm going to miss class tomorrow. Artie's freaking out and wants to fly to New York to panic at me in person, and now there are people who know what I am living in the same building as me. I know what you are, I protested. I've always known. You don't look at me like that, Verity. You've never looked at me like that. I sighed. Okay, fair. Look, you don't have to stay here. You can go and stay with the dragons down in the sewers. You know William would be happy to have you. Sarah shook her head. I can't. Even if I was comfortable leaving you alone, which I'm not. You don't have to stay for my sake. I can take care of myself. I don't care if you think you can take care of yourself. I'm not leaving you, Sarah repeated more firmly. But even if I was, there's no internet or cell service in the nest. The dragons don't consider it a priority. All their calls are made on an old landline the city put in for the municipal workers, and they'd slit their wrists before they paid for smartphones. If I drop off the grid like that, Artie will be on the next plane out of Portland, and I'm not going to be the reason he puts himself in danger. I can't. Right. I sighed, rubbing the back of my neck with one hand. One day, those two are going to admit that they're in love with each other. Until then, we're all going to stay stuck in the middle of their not a relationship. Well then, I guess we're all just going to have to cope. Yeah, agreed Sarah miserably. We are. I got Sarah settled back in her room/office, largely by promising to pick up some tomato juice the next time I had to go out to the nest, which was going to be soon. My feet were already starting to itch with the need to go, to run, to move. I'd been sitting still for hours, and being in the car while Uncle Mike drove us around New York didn't count. It just made me feel even less like I was in control of the situation. Holding up and laying low might be the smart thing to do, but doing the smart thing has never been a Price family tradition. We are more interested in running straight into the jaws of danger and daring it to bite down. There might be more of us among the living if danger weren't so very willing to take us at our word and bite. That doesn't change the fact that somebody has to do the job we do, and we're uniquely qualified for it. We've been breeding to die this way for generations. The mice were still enjoying their celebration, or maybe they'd started a new one. It can be hard to tell with them. I peeked through the office window long enough to reassure myself that they weren't about to set the place on fire or anything. Then I started moving again, heading for my own makeshift bedroom. I needed to know what was going on out in my city, and that meant I needed to be out, not dealing with evacuating the resident cryptids or getting my relatives out of the line of fire. First things first. I stripped off the clothes I'd been wearing to go see Sarah and changed into my usual night-running gear, a skin-tight gray bodysuit that would render me virtually invisible in the shadows, a belt that made me feel a little bit like Batman, since he's the sort of platonic ideal of person running around in spandex with their weapons around their waist, and a cotton hoodie only slightly darker than the bodysuit. With the hood pulled up to hide my hair and face, I could disappear on the rooftops, becoming part of the scenery. Combat boots and a backpack full of ammo, replacement knives, and climbing gear completed my preparations. I was loaded for bear, literally. And if I was lucky, that would translate into being loaded for Healy. If I was really lucky, the question would never come up. I went thumping back down the stairs to the ground floor of the slaughterhouse. There was no one there. I took that to mean that they were still where I'd left them, and walked toward the kitchen, using the stroll as an excuse to test the weight of my backpack. It was a little heavier than I would have liked, but it was perfectly balanced, and in the end, that mattered more than a few extra pounds. It's not how much you're carrying, it's what you do with it. And I was planning on unleashing a world of hurt on anyone who got in my way. "Uncle Mike?" I stuck my head into the kitchen. Sunil and Roshak were at the stove, frying something that smelled like taffy, while Eastus looked on appreciatively. Uncle Mike was sitting at one of the card tables, sharpening his knives. From the assortment he had spread out in front of him, he'd been at it since he left me alone with Sarah, and was planning to be at it for quite a while longer.
"What is it, Vary?" he asked, looking up. "Everything okay with Sarah?"
Sunil and Roshak stiffened at the question. Wow, I could already tell that we were entering a new era of fun times here in our hidey hole. Good thing I was planning to get the hell out for a little while. "She's miserable, but she'll cope," I said as casually as I could. "I guess being judged by her species makes her unhappy."
"I am very sorry," said Sunil in a soft voice. "It was instinctive."
I paused and took a breath before saying, "Just try to keep it cool until all this is over, please. My whole family vouches for Sarah. She's one of us, and just like everyone else here, she's stressed enough not to need an extra dose of feeling terrible about herself. She didn't choose her species, any more than I chose to be born a Price, or Dominic chose to be born into the Covenant. We were all of us, dealing with the hands we were dealt."
"We will treat her with as much kindness and respect as she treats us," said Roshak.
"I can't ask you for more than that." I turned back to Uncle Mike. "Can you please help Sarah finish getting us on the Internet? I'd feel better if I could check my email, and Sarah's a lot less likely to freak out if she can chat with Artie."
"I'm on it."
Mike stood, leaving his knives on the table.
"Heading out?"
I smiled a little. "What was your first clue?"
"Call it intuition. You'll be careful out there."
"As careful as I can be."
"I don't like this."
"You don't have to." I needed to move, or I was going to scream. "Keep an eye on things here. If anything goes wrong..."
"I'm here to make sure nothing goes wrong," said Mike implacably.
His tone was flat, the verbal equivalent of a brick wall suddenly appearing in my path.
"Call if you need help, or if you're going out of cell range for more than a few minutes. I want to be able to reach you if anything comes up here."
"Deal. Eastus, Mike's in charge until I get back." The irony of telling the woman who could possibly bench-press a Buick to obey the human wasn't lost on me. It wasn't lost on Eastus, either. She raised one eyebrow, looking amused. Then she nodded and agreed.
"Yes. I will listen to the man I have just met when he is making judgments regarding my safety and the safety of my mate."
"See, the sad thing is, I know you mean that..." It took me a while to learn to speak Wahila. After being Eastus's co-worker for a year, I had it pretty much down. If it sounds sarcastic, it isn't, If it involves a threat of physical violence, it's sincere. But unless it comes with claws, it's probably friendly. Like having a pet wolverine with rabies. Easta smiled.
Precisely. Enjoy your hunt for things to hurt. Save some carnage for the rest of us.
I will, I said, and turned, walking back out into the main room. I paused by the table where we'd left Margaret's weapons, picking up her telepathy-blocking charm and dropping it into one of the pockets of my backpack. If things were calm enough to allow for a few personal errands, I'd take it by the freak show. Boogeymen are some of the best information brokers and rumor mongers in the world. Kitty might know how the thing worked, and better, how we could counter it. What's the point of having a telepathic early warning system if you can't use it? The stairs beckoned me upward, but I forced myself to ignore them, walking instead to the door leading out to the small, enclosed courtyard. Much as I hated to start any journey on the ground, I didn't want to risk attracting attention by taking the same path too many times. That meant starting from a different rooftop. I crossed the courtyard to the abandoned bodega, and from there, made my way out to the street. New York is the city that never sleeps, but there are still neighborhoods that quiet down after a certain hour, losing the majority of their vibrancy and life in favor of stillness and the dark. Being popular with the tourists has done a lot to revitalize the meatpacking district. That also means that it's one of the areas that clears out quickly after midnight. A few well-dressed people on their way home from the bars lingered, but the streets were otherwise left to the homeless, the taxi drivers, the lost, and of course, the cryptids. I recognized them by the way they wore their hats, pulled low over their faces, and the quick anxiety of their steps. The Covenant had everyone on edge. Most of all, the people who inhabited this shadowy slice of the Big Apple. I kept close to the buildings as I walked, looking for a good route upward. I found it about 3 blocks away from the nest, at a corner that seemed to be in deeper shadow than most of the others, where the cornices of the building formed an almost perfect series of handholds. I glanced around once, making sure that no one was looking at me. Then, I reached up and started to climb. There's a security on the rooftops of a major city that I never feel anywhere else, a feeling like I could run forever if I had to. The city limits always loom, but no one can chase in a straight line across the slope of that much disparate architecture. There's always a chance to double back and find another way. It would take an army to take me out when I'm that far above the street. With no real idea of where I was going or what I was going to do when I got there, I took a long step backward, tensed, and ran. Running helped to clear my head, allowing me to review the events of the night so far in a clearer, more rational light. Bad. Margaret Healy had seen me, and even if she didn't know for sure who I was, she knew I was someone who wasn't on her side. Not even an idiot could wake up face down on the carpet of someone else's hotel room, wrists and ankles taped together, and not realize that something was probably up. Good. Even if she'd seen me, she didn't know for sure who I was, or that I had anything to do with Dominic. She might be furious. She would be furious, if she was anything like every other member of our mutual family. But she wouldn't know where to start looking for me. Bad. Sarah's cover had been blown, and gingerbread pudding was no longer safe. Good. I'd managed to get Sunil, Roshak, and Sarah all to safety before the Covenant could reach them, and under the circumstances, that was a victory. Better yet, the freak show was still secure. We had options. They might not be as diverse as I would have liked them to be, but at least they existed. Bad. Dominic was with the Covenant, at least for the moment. And that was good at the same time, because he'd called to warn me about Sunil and Roshak, and there'd been no ambush waiting for me. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe Margaret had just been at the Port Hope for the normal reasons, and he hadn't betrayed us. When this was over, it wasn't impossible to think that maybe when this was all over, he'd be standing with me, not against me. Covenant members had chosen to walk away from their duty before. I was living proof of that. I was so lost in thought that I misjudged the drop as I leaped from one roof to another. I landed harder than I intended to. I caught myself with my hands before I could faceplant on the roof. The gesture cost me a lot of momentum, and rather than trying to get started again, I let myself skid to a stop, turning my feet to the side to increase my friction. Once the last of my inertia had bled off, I straightened, looking around. I was near the freak show, in one of those weird New York neighborhoods that mixes commercial and residential buildings in a patchwork of brownstone, concrete, and glass. I walked to the edge of the roof, looking down. There were a few people on the street, and the ubiquitous taxis slid endlessly by. But everything was silent, or as close to silent as New York ever gets. It was a real cinematic moment, the sort of thing that normally only exists in movies. The sound of a gun being cocked somehow managed to fit right in. I stiffened.
"Hello," said Margaret from behind me, her sharp British accent somehow turning that single word into a threat. "I was wondering when you'd arrive." Then her gun caught me across the back of the head. I had just enough time to realize that I'd done something completely stupid, and that wasn't like me. What the hell was I doing? Before I fell. The last thing I heard was the sound of my own body hitting the rooftop, a heavy, wet thud, like a sack of cement being dropped. Then, there was nothing.
Chapter 16. Damn. Alice Healy. A converted slaughterhouse in the meatpacking district, resuming narration with the assistance of Sarah Zellaby. The ceiling in my temporary room was water-stained enough that it sort of looked like a magic eye puzzle, one of those pictures that's supposed to resolve into three dimensions if you stare at it long enough. It was a far cry from the kind of hotel where I usually stayed. It was even a far cry from the Port Hope, where I could probably have found a few water stains if I'd been willing to look hard enough. It was better than being dead. I stretched out on the air mattress with my hands folded behind my head, squinting up at the ceiling. Maybe it would be a sailboat, or a functional solution for the Riemann hypothesis. Either one would be fine with me. I was starting to relax when pain flared into sudden life at the back of my skull, as intense as if I'd somehow slammed my head into the concrete floor. Only I hadn't moved. I cried out, too startled to do anything else, and sat up, clapping a hand over the spot. The pain got worse. And then it was gone, disappearing as suddenly as it had come. 1 second pain, the next second, no pain. I lowered my hand slowly, waiting for the pain to come back. It didn't. Everything was silent. That was when I realized that the sense of Verity's presence, a low constant, as long as we were within a few miles of each other, even if I normally couldn't hear her when we weren't in the same building, was gone. "Verity?" I thought, as hard as I could. At this distance, she shouldn't have been able to answer me, but there should have been something. There was nothing. I staggered to my feet, trying to make sense of the silence. It was the loudest thing I'd ever heard. I've had family around me for as long as I can remember, people I was so telepathically attuned to that I could hear them without trying. It was disorienting, like blowing out the last candle in the middle of a blackout. It was also terrifying, because I didn't know what it meant, but I suspected. "Uncle Mike!" The words came out in a wail as I turned and bolted for the door. The main room of the slaughterhouse was empty. I practically flew down the stairs, following the vague sense of people this way, to the kitchen, where Eustace and the Madura were sitting around a table. I grabbed the edge of the doorframe to keep myself upright, aware that I had to look half insane with worry, and not really giving a damn. "Where's Mike?" I demanded. Eustace blinked.
"You are distressed," she said. "Why? Are we under attack?"
"I don't know," I said. "Where's Mike?
I need him. Tell me where he is. I couldn't resist giving a telepathic push at the end, trying to make her tell me. I encountered nothing. No resistance, no response. Eustace might as well have been a rock for all the effect that I had on her mind. That was what I got for trying to push someone who wasn't human. I'm more attuned to humans than I am to any other species, even my own. Eustace was the only Wahila I'd ever met, and I had no idea how to make her do what I wanted. I couldn't even pick up on her thoughts, just her emotions, and even those were blurry, like I was reading them through thick fog. Luckily for me, she felt like playing along.
"He is in what was originally the foreman's office," she said. "I believe he is attempting to make the internet function, so you can communicate with the outside world, and I can go shopping."
A brief scowl crossed her face.
"I hope this is resolved soon. Verity will not allow me to have things shipped here, and Kitty becomes annoyed if I receive more than one package per day."
I stared at her. The Covenant was in town, and Verity had gone silent in my head, but Eustace was worried about the mail. Verity would probably have called that proof that trivial desire endures no matter what, allowing our minds to find stability under the most chaotic conditions. Then she would have made a bad dance pun. All it made me do was want to scream. I swallowed my first three responses before asking, "Where is the foreman's office?"
"He said that he would be in the office in the leftmost corner," said the younger Medora.
I could feel him at the edge of my mind, a little static melody against the louder, less delicate noise generated by Eustace. I couldn't feel his brother at all. If I hadn't been looking at the table, I would have assumed that only two people were there.
"Are you well, Lady Jorlak?"
the older Medora hissed.
"Sunil, do not insult her!"
"I'm sorry." Waves of stricken embarrassment that I didn't understand washed off the younger Medora.
"I meant no offense."
Exhaustion swept over me, washing the Medora's incomprehensible embarrassment away. I shook my head. "It's fine. I need to go talk to Uncle Mike." He would know what to do. He would know what to tell me. Standing in this kitchen with three relative strangers, the only thing I could think to do was crawl back into my bed and wait until this all blew over, and I knew that wouldn't help anyone. "Thanks for your help," I said. Then I turned and left the kitchen. Somehow I managed not to start running again until I was out of their sight. This time I looked for the sound-slash-feeling of a human mind nearby, and followed it to the office where Uncle Mike was setting up a cable router on another of the folding card tables that seemed to be everywhere around the nest. He didn't look up when he heard my footsteps, but his thoughts tensed, going from calm to on alert without visibly changing his posture. I glanced toward his hand. He had a knife that I was pretty sure hadn't been there a moment before.
"What's going on, Sarah?" he asked.
His question was calm, reasonable, and the last straw for my overstretched nerves. "I can't find Verity," I wailed.
"What?"
Uncle Mike lifted his head. Concern baked off him like heat off pavement in the summer sun.
"Verity went out for a run to clear her head. She should be back in a little while. Is there something I can help you with?"
I took a deep breath. Sometimes humans can be so slow. Choosing my words carefully, I said, "I don't mean she's not in the building. I knew that. I mean I can't find her anywhere in the city. I should be able to find her no matter where she is in the city. And if she left, I should have had time to realize that she was moving farther away. I was in my room when my head started hurting like my skull was busted. Then the pain went away, and Verity was just gone." Uncle Mike stood slowly, putting both modem and knife down on the table.
"Sarah, are you telling me Verity's dead?"
Those were the words I'd been most afraid of hearing. Tears suddenly burned in the corners of my eyes. I managed to swallow and forced myself to shrug, whispering, "I don't know. I've never been connected to anyone who died before. I don't know what it would feel like.
Maybe she's dead. I don't know.
Shh, Sarah. Shh.
He closed the distance between us in 3 long steps, putting his arms around me and gathering me close to him. It was a human gesture, and not one I was entirely comfortable with, but I let myself be gathered, pressing my face against his chest and sobbing. At least there was a layer of fabric between his skin and mine. He stroked my hair with one hand.
You need to calm down, okay? Can you do that for me? Because if Verity's out of the picture, we have to figure out what we're going to do, and I need you to be with me for that. So let it out, and let yourself calm down.
How can you say that? I demanded, my throat too full of tears and snot, since mucus production is one of the biological traits that cuckoos are lucky enough to share with the human race, for me to speak. Mike didn't respond. He just kept stroking my hair. Slowly I realized that he hadn't heard me. I can only communicate telepathically with people I'm attuned to, and that requires spending a certain amount of time in my physical company. Uncle Mike and I only saw each other at holidays, if then, and I usually spent Christmas and Thanksgiving hiding in my room. If we were in Columbus, or hiding in Artie's room, if we were in Portland. Without Verity, there was no one left who could hear me when I didn't remember to talk out loud. Swallowing to try and clear some of the stickiness from my throat, I pushed away from Mike and said, "Verity's not out of the picture, okay? She's just missing. I don't know how or why, but she's not out of the picture. She's not gone. Don't you let yourself think that she is, not for an instant, or I swear, I will make you regret it."
I'm not saying she's dead, Sarah. But if you can't find her, and you hurt before she disappeared, there's a pretty good chance that she's not in fighting shape right now. We're going to need to find her, and you've been here a lot longer than I have. So what do we do?
The word panic rose to the tip of my tongue. I swallowed it and said, "We need to call the freak show. Kitty will know if anyone saw anything."
Boogeymen aren't always happy to share information. Kitty had a relationship with Verity. What makes you think that she'll talk to us?
He was already referring to Verity in the past tense. I didn't think he even realized he was doing it. I swallowed again, this time to stop myself from screaming, and said, "Kitty's relationship with Verity is why she'll talk to us. Kitty and Verity have an understanding, and Kitty and I know each other." Calling us friends would have been too much of a stretch, but allies by necessity was a pretty accurate description. Kitty would want Verity to be okay. If there was any way for her to help us out, she would.
"Okay," said Uncle Mike. "So you go call the freak show."
"What are you going to do?"
"Check the defenses. Make sure there's a lot of traps set, and change anything Verity would have known how to get around."
His tone was apologetic, and his words were accompanied by a wave of sorrow and determination so emotionally loud that I could have picked it up from a complete stranger.
"We gotta assume she's compromised, kiddo. And that means we batten down the hatches and we get ready for the siege to begin. Now, get Kitty on the phone and find out if there's anything she can do to help us get Verity back. You're the one who comes closest to knowing what happened to her, and I've got work to do."
With that, he turned and walked out of the room, leaving me standing alone, staring after him, with absolutely no idea what I was supposed to do. No, that wasn't true. I pulled my phone out of my pocket and started scrolling through my contacts. I would call the freak show. Kitty would know what to do. Someone would know what to do. Because I didn't have a clue.
"You've reached the freak show," said the bored, half-attentive voice of Angel, the bar's only human bartender. "We're closed right now, but if you'd like to come see us tomorrow night, we'd be happy to make all your dreams come true."
It might have been easier to believe her if she hadn't punctuated her words with the sound of gum being noisily snapped. "Angel, this is Sarah Zellaby, Verity's cousin. Is Kitty available?"
"Who?"
Angel's tone changed over the course of that single syllable, going from distracted to fully focused on the phone.
"You're the blue-eyed girl, right? The one that comes in with Vary some nights."
I could practically hear her thoughts rearranging themselves, making me important to her. My telepathy doesn't work at a distance, but Angel had been in my sphere of influence before. Cuckoo tricks can linger.
"Is everything okay?"
"Not really, no," I said. "Is Kitty available?"
"Yeah. Yeah, hang on."
There was a soft scraping sound as she cupped her hand over the receiver. She may as well not have bothered. I heard her clearly when she shouted,
"Hey, Carol! Tell Kitty she's got a priority call on line 2.
The scrape repeated as Angel took her hand away. Then she said, in a more reasonable tone,
"She should be with you in a second. Sorry about the wait."
"It's okay." I started walking in a circle around the card table, trying to calm myself down. It wasn't working very well. I tried another tactic. "You're still working? Even with everything that's going on?"
"I like it here," said Angel. "The Covenant of Saints Stupid isn't going to chase me off a job I actually enjoy just because they've decided to get judgmental about my co-workers. Kitty said I could have the time off without penalty, no problem. And I told her I'd rather stick with my friends. Some assholes want to come in here and start hacking? I'll be right there with my pepper spray."
A nervous giggle welled up in my throat. "That's a really good attitude. Thanks."
"Don't thank me. It's the right thing to do."
There was a clunking noise, followed by Kitty saying,
"Thanks, Angel. You can hang up now." "Anytime, Kitty. Sarah, hope everything gets better for you. You sound stressed."
A click and a change in the quality of the sound over the line told me that Angel had hung up on her end. "Hello?" I said.
"Sarah Zellaby," said Kitty.
Her voice seemed to come from next to me rather than through the phone. That's a classic boogeyman trick. They can throw their voices anywhere they can hear, which includes the other end of telephone lines. Just one more way nature and technology combine to make the world a creepier place.
"Verity's little adopted cousin with the big blue eyes and the clear antifreeze for blood. What brings a cuckoo like yourself to my virtual door?"
Humans have only known about cuckoos for a few generations. The boogeyman have known for centuries, and, surprise, surprise, they don't like us much. That's something they have in common with every other sapient species in the known world.
"It's Verity," I said. "I can't find her."
There was a long pause. Knowing what cuckoos were meant that Kitty also understood what we could do.
"I'm listening," she said.
I gave her the same explanation I'd given Uncle Mike, dwelling a little longer on the static and the way it had gone away completely when the pain did. I finished by saying, "I'm scared. I think something terrible may have happened to her."
"Before we start jumping at sunbeams, let me ask you this. Is there any chance you're having the cuckoo equivalent of a muscle cramp or something? Maybe you can't feel her because you've got a problem, not because she's not there."
"I can feel everyone else in the building."
Everyone except the older Madura. Verity had said his name was Rorschach, but his thoughts had been hidden before Verity disappeared. Bringing him into this would just confuse things.
"Besides, this isn't the sort of silence I get when someone blocks me out. I mean, it is, but that never starts with pain. I've never felt anything like that before."
Kitty made a small, frustrated sound.
"Which means, if I believe you, that the damn Covenant probably got her. Fuck. Do you think they killed her quick, or did they take her prisoner so they could torture her first?"
My breath caught in my chest, wedging there like a stone. I struggled to force it out, trying to get my voice back. Finally I said, "How can you even ask me that?"
"Look, Sarah, for you, she's family. I get that, I really do. And it sucks that you're the one making this call, almost as much as it sucks that I'm the one taking it. But if she's dead, she's dead, and I have living people to worry about. If the Covenant knows what Verity knows, they can clean this city out.
You follow me? Nobody's safe if they're torturing her. And don't try telling me that she won't break. Given enough time and enough knowledge.